Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to have the Pierces join us. Glad to be back from vacation. Yeah, I was. My teaching was a little interrupted by back surgery a couple of weeks ago. It'll be my third back surgery. It was supposed to patch me for the serious surgery to take place next year when I was going to have yet another double fusion. And they opened me up and looked and said, no, it's not too bad, actually. And they took out the screws, the loose screws. Rumors are true, I have had loose screws. So I had a double fusion back in October. The bottom fusion, S1 sacrum, to the bottom lumbar vertebra, L5, is all fine. It had failed earlier. They redid it, and now it works. L4, L5, healing more slowly, but sufficiently healed that they took the screws out, which had been giving me a lot of trouble with my back. You know, something about putting screws through nerves kind of problem. And so spasms and pain and such, that all came out. But the doctor looked at it and said, this is actually healing up. It looks much better live than it did in the MRIs, which looked terrible. So I will not have to have another back surgery. And having those screws out, really nice. You just can't imagine. And then on my way back from the hospital where I was feeling so much better, I passed a kidney stone, except I failed to actually pass the kidney stone, so that goes back to DCH, and they had to yank that thing out of me. And so I took a week off. I feel much better now. Yeah, kidneys have been flushed clean, and no more loose screws. I do have screws in me left, so there may be loose. There may still actually be loose screws, but the ones we knew about, they're gone. A week of recovering helped quite a lot. Plus, I got a coffee holder now. It's really nice. Last week of the quarter. This week, I'm scheduled to talk about messianic prophecies, which I do want to do, but in kind of thinking through it, it's always been an encouragement when I've studied these, when I've taught these, to see how well, you know, what Jesus did and the events of the Gospels line up with what the prophecies said would happen. Knowing that those prophecies were made hundreds of years before the time of Christ. But in thinking through it, it occurred to me that one of the weaknesses of this kind of teaching, particularly when we're talking about apologetics, is that while it's easy enough to demonstrate that Jesus is the Messiah based on the messianic prophecies, what we fail to cover is why that really matters, or to the extent that it matters. When we were baptized, the confession we made, this is the King James Version, which is how I've confessed it, you know. We've since gone to the NIV version, works just as well, but I remember it in King James, is Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. The great confession Peter gave at Caesarea Philippi. Not anybody who's ever taught class where I've prepared the materials, because that would be cheating. What does it mean to say Jesus is the Christ?
Messiah.
Very good. So now we've gone from Greek to Hebrew. What does it mean to say Jesus is the Messiah?
The anointed one.
Yeah, literally, it means anointed one. Sometimes just translated the anointed, God's anointed, the Lord's anointed. So what does that mean? I mean, somebody poured oil on his head, I guess. Although there's no recorded event where anybody poured oil on Jesus' head. But to anoint someone is to anoint with oil, right? Who was famously anointed with oil in the Old Testament? David. Saul before him. And then David. David actually is recorded having that happen three times. Once by Samuel and a couple other times later. It was a ceremony by which somebody was inaugurated as king, right? So it's just, it's a metaphor, and it means king. But for most of us, what we think it means, or how we, the part we emphasize in our thinking and our teaching, and what we, a lot of us thought we were confessing when we confessed it to be baptized is, well, let's come back to that. What does it mean to say son of God? If you confess, I believe Jesus is the Son of God, what are you saying about Jesus? He's deity. We're sons of God, daughters of God. It'd be fun to be deity, but I'm not. Sometimes I wish it was true.
One born in the likeness of is the phrase I've always thought of.
In the image of God, kind of. Yeah, of course, we're in the image of God. I mean, that's all correct. It's very unlikely that's what Peter thought when he said this. Turn to Psalm 2. Yeah. Got a new Bible. It's harder to find things than it used to be. There it is. Psalm 2. If you're familiar with Handel's Messiah, these words will ring true. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his Messiah, in the Hebrew, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. So the rulers of the nations do not want to be subject to the Messiah. He who sits in the heavens laughs, and the Lord holds him in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them, the nation, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, which is where the palace sits in Jerusalem, the Mount Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Son of God. All right. Son of God. In Psalm 2 and in the Old Testament, not it's not the only meaning of it, but it's the meaning that this comes from, is a parallel to Messiah, but the king of Israel was called the Son of God. So to confess Jesus as Son of God is not so much to say the Nicene Creed is correct and he is co-equal with God, although it is correct and he is co-equal with God. Okay, I'm not challenging that. That's not Peter's point. Right? Peter was quoting from Psalm 2. And he was saying, you're the guy that Psalm 2 is talking about. You're the guy that the nations are going to rebel under and yet will rule the world. God's king. I will tell the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Begotten means to have conceived you. So that is arguably, in fact, a reference to the virgin birth, right? I conceived you, God. I did. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. The nations won't like it, but Jesus will rule the world, is what the psalm says. Sitting on David's throne in Israel. To confess that he's the Son of God is to confess that he's the king who rules the world. It takes me back to the first children's church lesson I ever taught. Jesus is king. That was the theme of the lesson. That was the whole lesson. Children's church, you don't have to say much. Except we did do the life application. If Jesus is king, what does that mean? We obey Jesus. Right? It's not complicated. What's the point of saying that God is living? He's present, yes. I think it's important from at least two perspectives, and probably 20 if we thought about it, but...
He remains active.
Yeah, there you go. It's maybe something David talked about in 1000 B.C., 3,000 years ago, but this is the work of the God who lives, who is still active in our lives, and it matters today because God is working his plan even yet. All right? Now, the other part of this is, if you remember the Ray Vanderland lesson on this same passage, it was at Caesarea Philippi, which was an area where they worshiped the Greek god Pan. And Peter was also probably saying, the living God in contrast to the dead gods that are being worshiped by the Greeks here in Caesarea. But his point would be the same. Our God lives. Right? Now, if this is true, it changes a lot of things. And it changes how we read the prophecies. Right? So when we read Psalm 2, it's not just, oh, look, Jesus will be begotten of God by a virgin. It's true. But it's also true that, and what it means is, Jesus rules as king. And God's alive and active, and it matters. And it's hard, I find it hard to kind of articulate why that is so revolutionary and why we so often fail to live up to what we confess. But I found a blog by a guy named Mark Love. Mark was a professor at Abilene. He now, I think, heads the Bible department at Rochester University. He posts a blog, which I think is wonderful. You should read it. You should read mine first, then his second. But it's called Deliberations, D-E-I hyphen Liberations. And he says lots of powerful things. I've learned a lot from him. This is from the April 4 blog, and it's on apologetics. His students had just gone to Oklahoma Christian, which is some distance away from Rochester, to hear N.T. Wright speak. And N.T. Wright is one of the greatest living theologians, making huge contributions to our understanding of scriptures and changing how the entire Protestant world thinks about things. Not throwing away everything, but enriching it, deepening it. So he writes, so after our gospel discussions in class, hearing N.T. Wright say that Paul's central message is not justification by faith, and reading your baptism post on your blog, I have a question. This is someone writing to Mark Love. I have a question that is constantly on my mind. One of the reviewers of Wright's new book asked a great question. Now that we have this new view of Paul and his writings, what does this look like on the ground for the church? Now, the new view of Paul he's talking about is that Paul's major theme, and of course he obviously taught and believed justification by faith, all right? But that was not the centerpiece. The centerpiece of his teaching was Jesus is the Messiah. And that changes everything. God has sent his king on earth to rule. All the prophecies have come true. And since we now have read the prophecies, we understand the prophecies, we know what's happening, and it changes everything, Jesus is the Messiah. And he died and was resurrected. And we see that as, well, that's something we should believe, that part of a creedal statement that ought to be true. This kind of defines us as a people. But we don't see it the way Wright teaches us to see it, which I think is how Paul tried to teach us to see it. So let me go through this. So let me see if I can spend some time on this question. Let me begin with a caveat. Well, skip. Let me start, though, with a scene from last night at Starbucks. I was sitting uncomfortably close within my introvert perimeter to a young couple having a very passionate conversation about God. She was a winsome evangelical. He was a skeptical something or other. She was giving this her all because it seemed to me they were serious about each other, but she could only marry a Christian. This was an all-or-nothing moment for her, and she was pulling out all the stops, and she was getting creamed. She was not getting creamed because she lacked intellectual ability or because she was a better debater. She was getting creamed because she had a story that's tough to defend. It wasn't just that he disagreed with her. He was offended by her view of God. This is apologetics. Her story was predictable. All of us are sinners. True. And it takes only one sin to make us unacceptable to God. True. And there's hell to pay, literally, true. God can't simply forgive our mistakes. He has to have a victim before he can forgive, a blood sacrifice. So he sends his own son to die for us to appease his otherwise unappeasable wrath. For the young man, this made God a monster. It failed for him precisely at the level of being moral. God really can't forgive me for a mistake unless someone dies. With all that's wrong with the world, disease, war, hunger, slavery, God is obsessed with who I sleep with. He kept telling her that he was a good person who cared for others and took care of the earth and cared about global issues of justice, and God was going to send him to hell for premarital sex. He did seem a little preoccupied with sex. Now, I won't take time to dissect the particulars of her story or the problems with his critiques. I want to look at the starting place in her story. Her story had as its center the problem of individual sin. Everything flowed from that premise. As a result, her rhetorical strategy began with isolating him in sin and warning him of the grave dangers to him personally. All right? Now, he is isolated in sin, and he does have grave dangers. All right? That's true. The point is not that that is false, but that that is this little piece of a much bigger story. Okay? It is true. God sent his son to take on our sins for us to be forgiven and live with him forever. Right? And that's true. Nobody contradicts any of that. But the point is, that's not the point. The point, the problem with that story is, well, what do I do after I'm baptized and before I die? Right? I've been forgiven. Mission accomplished. I guess I just try not to mess it up so bad that I don't make it to heaven. You know, it's kind of a defensive strategy. While I was recovering in the hospital, I watched an episode of Big Bang Theory. Amy Farrah Fowler said, Sheldon asked her, she's his girlfriend, do you believe in a God? And she said, well, I have no problem believing in a deity. I just can't accept one who takes attendance. It's a small God that we worship sometimes, you see. The point is, our God's bigger than that. So let's try on a story that doesn't begin with the individual as the issue. What if she started this way? We live in a world that is totally screwed up. Sex trafficking, poverty, disease, environmental disasters. Ferguson, Missouri. ISIS or whatever that thing is in Iraq. Christians being persecuted in Mosul. Right? Easy case to make. World's messed up. We've made a hash of it. True. And being a really good person isn't the answer. Not by itself. Right? We're good people. Problem's not solved. We're really good people and know a lot of other really good people, and we fix some things, and some things don't get any better, and some get worse. Even science, which makes our lives better in so many ways, also threatens to wipe us from the face of the earth. True enough. You know, we're scared of the Ebola virus for good reason, despite all the technology and money we spend on healthcare, right? Sometimes the germs win. And my question is, where is God in all of this? And he agrees and hopes you have a satisfying answer. The Christian story says that God has revealed his power. That's a true story, by the way. I don't mean false story. Christian story says that God has revealed his power in a story of selfless love, which is the opposite of what the Bible calls sin and identifies as the root of this whole mess. God's solution to the problem is not power as control over the contingencies of this life. Rather, the Christian view of the world is that God suffers with us, joins us, endures with us, and works for justice through paths of faithful love. Love not as just an emotion, but love as a way of always acting for us. And ultimately, this is the power through which all things will be made whole. The death of Jesus on a Roman cross is a demonstration that there is no power or circumstance that places us outside of his love. And his resurrection from the dead says to us that the powers of sin and death don't have the final word. And the church is a group of people who live by the power of this selfless love, which the Holy Spirit gives to us, and who live in resistance to all other powers that would shape life in distorting or unjust ways, who live as a sign of God's future, where all things will be made whole. This takes more than just good people or moral people. Christians hardly have that market cornered, and it takes people who share a commitment to this way of being in the world. And when you live this way with others, you learn to recognize the unmistakable ways that God shows up, like those moments of power when we learn to forgive each other the way God lavishly forgives us. And when I live in this story, I find myself being transformed by the love of God. The way this world gets on you and in you and contaminates you and weighs you down with shame and guilt and condemnation is defeated. And this transformed way of life survives everything, even death. Right? Very different way of looking at things. Not inconsistent, right? But the bigger story is not God came to rescue me, Jesus is my personal Savior, I now have a personal relationship with Jesus, although that is all true, right? It is, he says, maybe he buys it, maybe he doesn't, but the point is a different starting place makes a huge difference. By moving the primary issue from the individual to creation and history, the story unfolds in a different way. And you might tell it differently than I did. For instance, Paul doesn't tell it precisely this way, but he's starting with a different audience. I was starting with a young man at Starbucks. The variety of audiences is one reason the Bible doesn't tell the story in only one way. If the Bible doesn't, why should we? And I'm convinced that if we place ourselves inside of a different story, it will change the way we do things as well. Okay? Now, I'll give you a for instance. Let's imagine a church founded by the God who created the world through his son who died on the cross that thinks that division along racial and economic lines is abhorrent. I would like to say that's the church that exists today, but I can't honestly say that because we got black churches and we got white churches. Right? What would Paul say if he showed up today and saw that we got black churches and we got white churches? How would he respond to that?
We'd probably get a letter.
We'd get a letter. Exactly right. That's right. That's right. They'd be first Tuscaloosans. You got to realize that most of Paul's letters, what they're about, and most of Acts, what it's about, is, guys, we cannot have Gentiles and Jews be separate. You dress different, you talk different, you think different, you got different cultures, you look different. But there's just one church. So we're not going to have a Jewish church where the Jews feel more comfortable and a Gentile church where the Gentiles feel more comfortable. We're going to have one church, and it's going to take me a whole lot of letters to get this right. But the whole point of Paul talking about justification by faith in Romans was to get to Romans 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, where he says, guys, get along. I mean, that's the point, you know. If you want to summarize the Sermon on the Mount, the ultimate lesson is, guys, get along. Right? Galatians about circumcision and such, and it's very theological and says all kinds of important things to us, but ultimately it is Hebrews, Jews, and Greeks, get along. Right? And that's the lesson that we've missed. I mean, I think all of Western Christianity has kind of whiffed on that one. And so it's my view, and it comes from this kind of thinking, that if we really believe that Jesus is the Messiah and he's king, right, then the powers that he opposes, which is everything else, have been defeated. And if God really is alive, then when we run into those powers, we're going to have to pick God's side and count on him to help us be victorious, right? And one of the powers that Jesus died to defeat was racism. A lot of other isms, right? And so when we see problems go up, you know, like Ferguson, Missouri, you can pick your side, you know, whatever, you know, you try to dissect it, whether it was a cop right or was a kid, you know, whatever. That's not the point, right? Why is it that the blacks and the white in that town are so separated and they feel the way they feel about each other? I think the reason is that the church has failed of its essential mission, right? Not about blame. It's about the fact that we were sent as God's people on a mission to change the world. Not that we can do that. Only God can do that, but we're supposed to be in there helping. The fact that Jesus is Messiah means there's only one king, only one church. Right? We're part of his kingdom. You can't have two churches. Can't be a black church. Can't be a white church. Can't be a Korean church. Can't be a Mexican church. Right? One church.
I think that one of the reasons Jesus addressed unity, you know, at a real crucial time for him was because of the dangers of disunity.
Yes.
You know, when we start being divided, you know, whether it's racism or whatever, one division usually leads to another one. And before we know it, we're so fragmented that we just can't accomplish what our mission should be.
Oh, exactly. I mean, Satan's winning, right? I mean, the divide and conquer, right? That's where the church is divided. We're not just divided on racial lines. We're divided on doctrinal lines and all kinds of other lines, right? There's all kinds of divisions within the church, and even within the Church of the Christ, there are divisions within our little subset of all of Christianity, right? The problem is, and I think this is one of the great mistakes of the Nicene Creed, which I think is true, okay? But what people did in response to that is they said, the way to please God is to believe exactly the right positions. If you're a little bit off on the Trinity, you go into hell. So suddenly what became the defining issue and doctrine of Christianity was, do you understand the Trinity correctly? Well, you can understand the Trinity very correctly and be completely useless to God's mission. You see? So when you look at the divisions within the churches of Christ, they're doctrinal divisions over do we understand things correctly, and since we disagree over how we understand things, we therefore must divide. But we all agree on this. I mean, we couldn't even get into the baptistry without having believed in this. Right? One king, one church. And so the point of Jesus being king and Messiah is that God has claimed the world as his own, says, this is mine, and I'm going to fix it. And we have chosen to be a part of that. See? Now, one of the great fringe benefits that goes with the program is a really great death benefit plan. Right? We get to go to heaven when we die. Right? But, you know, we're forgiven at the outset so we can be in fellowship with God, so that we can have the Holy Spirit, so that we can be part of his community, part of his family, because only sinless people get to be a part of God's world. The goal wasn't forgiveness. Forgiveness is a means to an end. And the end is we become part of God's family and we share in his mission. So all these prophecies that talk about the Messiah, we should read them not in terms of, oh, we're right. We got Jesus, got the question right, got the answer right. But what we don't read in those prophecies is what God is saying about why we do this, why I did this. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. You don't have to turn to this. I'm going to read faster than you can turn. For a child has been born to us, a son has been given to us. He shoulders responsibility and is called Extraordinary Strategist, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His dominion will be vast, and he will bring immeasurable prosperity. He will rule on David's throne and over David's kingdom, establishing it and strengthening it by promoting justice and fairness. What are we about as God's community? Justice and fairness. Right? We got people who are saying churches that talk about social justice are bad churches. No, they're messianic churches. See, that's what the Messiah came to bring, was justice. From this time forward and forevermore, the Lord's intense devotion to his people will accomplish this. Isaiah 11, 1. A shoot will grow out of Jesse's rootstock. A bud will sprout from his roots. Jesse's David's father. The Lord's spirit will rest on him, a spirit that gives extraordinary wisdom, a spirit that provides the ability to execute plans, a spirit that produces absolute loyalty to the Lord. He will take delight in obeying the Lord. He will not judge by mere appearances or make decisions on the basis of hearsay. He will treat the poor fairly and make right decisions for the downtrodden of the earth. Are we Messiah people or not? See? He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth and order the wicked to be executed. Justice will be like a belt around his waist. Integrity will be like a belt around his hips. A wolf will reside with a lamb, and a leopard will lie down with a young goat. An ox and a young lion will graze together as a small child leads them along. All right. Why did Jesus come? To bring justice, to lift up the oppressed, to care for the poor. This is a good prophecy. It really happened, but we think Jesus came. Yeah, but he came for a purpose. Isaiah 11:7. A cow and a bear will graze together. The young will lie down together. A lion like an ox will eat straw. A baby will play over the hole of a snake, over the nest of a serpent. An infant will put his hand. They will no longer injure or destroy on my entire royal mountain. For there will be universal submission to the Lord's sovereignty, just as the waters completely cover the sea. At that time, a root from Jesse will stand like a signal flag for the nations. Nations will look to him for guidance, and his residence will be majestic. So Jesus will call all the nations in to create one new nation. That'll be a united nation. Isaiah 42:6. I, the Lord, officially commission you. I take hold of your hand, I protect you, and make you a covenant mediator for people, and a light to the nations, to open blind eyes, to release prisoners from dungeons, those who live in darkness from prisons. I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not share my glory with anyone else, or the praise due me with idols. Look, my earlier oracles have come to pass, now I announce new events. Before they begin to occur, I reveal them to you. Let's go back to Psalm 'Messianic prophecies, and if you read them kind of fresh, you're not just looking to see, is it true? Does Jesus really fulfill the prophecies? And it is true. He really does fulfill the prophecies, and that's important. But you also ask, what do the prophecies say is going to happen when Jesus comes? Right, what's the world going to be like? What is God's purpose in doing all of this, right? There are passages that talk about forgiving sins, praise God, and there are passages that talk about getting to live with God forever, praise God. But most of the passages are about a revolutionized world where people live together differently, right? And the words that are used over and over again are righteousness and justice. In fact, you can, it's an interesting study, just to look up the word justice or righteousness in the Old Testament and read everything that's said on those two words. Almost all of the passages are about what God is going to do through Jesus.
Jay.
Yeah.
So, what does a church of justice and righteousness look like on earth? I mean, justice and fairness to me and righteousness are two different things. They seem different to me, but also justice, I was taught that justice was getting what you deserve, you know, and so it's. How do you fit a church of justice and fairness with grace and righteousness? I mean, how does that?
It's an interesting thing because you have to read it, you know, in context, of course, right? And there are two uses of justice in the prophecies, and they're both true. One of them is, you know, I'm going to be a fair judge, and I'm going to rule for the people who ought to win. I'm not going to be biased, like the earth courts, which were corrupt. I'm going to give you true justice. Right? That's one sense of justice, and that is part of the promise, right? But the other sense of justice is, I am going to give you what you as my children and as people made in the image of God deserve, which is, you know, a better world. And it's used in both senses. It's not one versus the other. I mean, both are promised. That's one reason in 1 Corinthians 6, Paul gets upset when the Christians are going to the secular pagan courts for justice. Paul says, you're going to judge the angels. How come you can't judge yourselves? Right, we don't understand that point. It's like, are you crazy? Have you met us? You know. But he's saying, look, as flawed as you are, imperfect as you are, you're God's people. You're called to a greater purpose. And you ought to be able to mete out justice because you've seen justice. You've seen Jesus. And in the end, we're called to be to judge the world, to sit on David's throne with Jesus. As part of, that's Ephesians 1 and 2 and Daniel. So we don't, we're not used to thinking in those terms. Now, the you know the other question I think you raised is, well, what can we do? And the answer is not that much. But what we can do is, A, recognize what the ideal is, right? We can hold, we can say, this is how it's supposed to be. And it's not how things are, right? Status quo is not right. God came to fix this. And we can then prophetically, i.e. like the Old Testament prophets, we can announce, oh, that's bad. That's wrong. Because it's contrary to God's will. It's not how things ought to be. And then in some circumstances, right, the Christian witness is actually capable of making dramatic change. It's not like you can just have a vote and have it happen, right? But as people's hearts are transformed by having a better vision of what Christianity is about and why we're Christians, right, then the way we live our lives and the way we live within our communities will change, right? And we'll look at questions differently. And we won't ask, well, was the cop right or was the kid right? You know, who is right? We'll ask, why is there such systematic injustice? Do these circumstances happen at all? Right? Why is there so much separation and division within society? And then we look a little harder, we say, well, goodness, the church has been in that town since its founding. Most of those people go to church. How come the church isn't educating us to act better? Well, it's because we got too small of a vision, right? We just want to get to heaven. That's done. We're going to go to heaven. Yeah, Adam.
It gets back to the two stories you started the class with, right? Not, yeah. I don't know if, you did, if this was what you were thinking, but the girl's story was a story of salvation.
Yes.
And Dr. Love's story was the story of community, kingship.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just so, when we make it personal, it allows us to live the rest of our lives according to what society tells us to do. And it's just this personal morality of this personal decision. But man, as soon as we choose, or as soon as we have to let Jesus be the king of actually the life, yeah, that's just, you know. Why is there division? Why did the church fail? Because the church teaches individual morality. It doesn't teach kingship. And it has failed to teach kingship appropriately.
Yeah, when the goal is just to not mess up so bad that you lose heaven, right? My mission is to, you know, be a decent person. And when the standard by which I'm judged is how faithfully I attend and whether I give money each week, right? Well, those are actually pretty easy things. And they're not going to change anything. They're not even going to change me. Not. You know, but if you say, no, that's just a piece of the bigger, right? And the bigger picture is not just the University Church of Christ. It's all of Christendom. Tell me that's not powerful. I mean, it's about 1 billion people. Surely we can do something, right? But it requires us having a vision of being something better. And literally, it goes back to, is Christ king of our lives? Is he king of the church? Is he king of the world? If he is, if we really believe that God's living, that he will help us do these things, or that he's going to do these things and invites us to join him as he do it, does it, is a better way to put it, right? Then that becomes realistic. No longer is it a question of, well, what can we do? The answer is not much. What can God do? Well, he said he will do it all. So when we participate, we know our efforts are not in vain. Rick?
I think that is why it's so important for us to do exactly what we've done the last couple, as this university to do what we've done the last couple of Sundays, and even more so in reporting on the missions of what God is doing to restore justice to the world. And I'm not saying that in an argument, I'm saying that hopefully in encouragement, but I've just heard a comment about just how things transpired in those two services that really discouraged me, and I want to say more of it. It's not that I don't need teaching. I'm here in the class and loving it, but we need to see the work of God, because otherwise we're just looking at stuff we're doing, and it's like having lunch just the daily practicality of life, and that's not enough.
Hey Mark,
I'm trying to read the book right now called Unfinished. It's kind of a sequel to Rich Stern's book, A Hole in Our Gospel, if you've read that. He's the CEO of World Vision, and he talks about this and challenges us as Christians to look at our salvation as something other than a fire insurance policy, but to look at it from the aspect of, Christ gave us the responsibility of establishing the kingdom of heaven on earth. And that's what he left us with. He showed us how it was supposed to work. And the whole book is about the premise behind, well, how do we as Christians attempt to do that? What does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a much different view of our responsibility as Christians than maybe the church has allowed what the definition of a Christian is.
That's very good. Now, a couple other books. N.T. Wright's How God Became King came out last year. Excellent read, not a hard read at all, and is exactly this. Or Scott McKnight's book, The King Jesus Gospel, is also excellent. Both of them are making the same points, although I prefer the Wright book. I think they're both great books. And I will not see you next week here. We're not have class next week, and then we change class this week after next. Thanks.
How are you?